Jim. How you doing? C.J. Douglas.
Good. How you doing?
Good. This is last time we talked. It was February, right?
Yeah. It was a while back. How you doing?
Very good. I'm well. The team's well. The second brigade is awesome, or at least it was as of last night the night before when we left them.
Great. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing. Are you on a speakerphone or something like that?
That's what I was going to ask. Was if it bothered you that I was on speaker?
Yeah, it's just
sometimes
really hard. I know everyone loves doing it, so
no
everyone
worries,
can hear. But and my hearing's bad enough as it is. So great. Well, how are you doing?
You and me both. I'm doing awesome.
Great. You know,
great.
I was looking on your bio. You're from Ballston Spa.
I am. Are you familiar with New York at all?
I used to work. I was a city editor at the Albany Times Union for about 6 or 7 years.
No kidding.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
So did you live down in Albany when you were there?
Yeah, I did.
Or did you live like in the Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, no, I live in Albany and actually in the city. We'd go up skiing a lot to the Adirondacks, so I'd drive through Saratoga all the time, and I'm somewhat familiar with the area. So.
Yeah, my wife and I grew up there and then left for active duty for the Marine Corps, came back because family stayed there, and every year when the snow starts flying, we ask the same question, like, why do we come back here?
You
can appreciate
brutal,
that.
Brutal winters. And so you're also you're a reservist?
I'm a reservist out of the 4th Marine Division. I'm actually assigned to the 4th Marine Division in the G3, and I'm a narcotics investigator for the New York State Police in my other life.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, no, I was when I got off of active duty in the 80s and then was in stayed in the reserves, but I was out in Texas where 4th Reconnaissance Battalion was, and I did that for a few years and then just got too busy with other stuff. So, but a great deal. Well, let me dive in a little bit here. For our purposes, I think people are kind of wondering, this sort of means with you guys leaving Sangin, then as far as the Marines are concerned, there are no more advisors out with, quote-unquote troops in the field. Is that kind of the big picture here?
As far as RC Southwest is concerned, we were the last advisors to lift off. And so the team of mine in Sangin, when we lifted off, the signal was the Afghan National Army was ready for us to lift off. We were, we all lifted off at that point. So, yeah, last ones.
Okay, so basically, so again, for civilians who may not know a corps from a CANDAC, from a brigade, to explain it to them, this is really, I guess, a sense of, again, removing advisors from accompanying Afghan troops in the field. Is that the best way to understand it?
Well, keep in mind, we were at the brigade level, so it was removing advisors from the regimental level, the equivalent of a regiment. So, what we would consider in our terms, 3,000 to 5,000 troops.
Yeah, right. What do you think our takeaway from that should be? What does that mean? What's the significance of that?
Well, it's significant in that they're on their own, but as far as in name, but the reality of it is they've been conducting their own planning and coordination and execution with minimal to no advisors present and really with minimal support for some time. I mean, they've been we had a number of successful operations. I think, were you out during OCOB 144 when they did the Sangin clear, correct? And then And so, you know, what they did from that was then they continued to conduct operations in preparation for the elections. And really, all that planning was on their own. And, you know, they would, you know, we would sit and talk about it, but, you know, really, they were going out. And as we saw, they had, let's call it a big win for as far as elections are concerned, going from only 77 people in 2009 to more than 5,000 in 2014. So their operations leading up to the elections were successful. You know, but it wasn't just the combat operations, because the brigade had this ability, and think back to your experience where we talk, you know, you have your population-centric coin and your enemy-centric coin, and so the brigade, specifically the brigade commander, was balancing, really reading the situation and applying what he needed to, like not shying away from a fight, but having the ability to identify when he needed to inject some population-centric coin. And so we saw an increase in him picking up with the coordination across all the ANTAP partners and, being the police and the governance just a great story in coordination, all while having a significant amount of key leader engagements where we got to the point he had to build a small meeting area for the locals to come and see him because he had exceeded his capacity in his small conference room. And so, but in addition to that, people would call with information and, you know, provide information, whether it was about IDs or people that were problems or, it showed an enhanced confidence in the ANA and in the governance as a whole.
Yeah. Now, Sangin had been a fairly violent place over time. Is there a way to quantify the security situation there now compared to a year or two back, either in terms of enemy-initiated attacks or whatever metrics you use?
Well, you know, while I wasn't there a year ago, you know, based on what I had learned from others that had been there and from the numbers, it was. But, you know, but what I can tell you is when we got there and as the brigade was regularly in contact, what we saw was based on the operations that they conducted in preparation for the elections, we saw a marked decrease in the number of engagements that they were having at the brigade and lower level.
Okay. And why was
so it? What that translates to is an enhanced security throughout AO Tripoli or, the second brigade's zone of action.
Yeah. And why do you think that is? Was the Taliban driven out? Are they waiting out U.S. Forces there? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I can't really speculate on it, but what it appears to be is, as I mentioned, the brigade commander was very calculated in balancing his enemy-centric coin and his population-centric coin. Like he engaged the local leadership and, you know, talked with them and had his public affairs execute messaging in support of the governance. And at the same time, you know, we know of a number of instances where, you know, with their tactical overmatch where they, you know, they took the fight to the enemy in advance, you know, and or, you know, took, seized the initiative from the enemy who may have engaged first, but but the ANA largely, you know, came out on top each time. So what that, I believe that did was it gave the local populace that confidence that, you know, as the insurgency had in some cases said, we're going to stand and fight, you know, prior to one of the operations they ran. When the Afghans came in and executed their clear, you know, the Taliban didn't. They didn't stay and fight. So they lost some credibility in the eyes of the people that said, you know, they said that they were going to stay here and fight, and they didn't. And, you know, you're definitely stronger than they are. You know, you're still here. So, you know, in one case, in one of their operations, they executed a clear and over a three-day period found 178 IEDs, you know, or improvised explosive devices. And I think that's huge. Now, it's not just that, you know, wow, they're amazing. They found that many. Like, they missed some, and some of the locals were like, hey, this is out of place, and, you know, this actually is, we think, is an IED. And so they started helping to point out IED locations to the Afghan National Army. And that's huge because it shows that level of confidence in the soldiers. So when you say, how is it, compared to a year ago, you know, just in the time that I was there, we saw an enhanced willingness of the local populace to work with the 2nd Brigade.
Yeah.
Which resulted in a decrease of kinetics.
Yeah. Sangin's the brigade there was the last to have Marine advisors. Is that
That's
right?
That's correct.
Okay. And why is that? In other words, was the situation there, was situation there more violent, or was the Taliban stronger there than in previous places, and so it took longer to achieve security there?
Well, they had some key leadership changes in, I think it was August. Given that it was a kinetic area for the 2nd Brigade and that they had some leadership changes, being decisions above me, as you can appreciate, but they, and with the elections coming up, you know, the decision was made to ensure that the brigade had reached a level of, reached a capacity that they were fully on their own. The current brigade commander is, is effective, is efficient, and, and as such, as time told, was, fully prepared to execute on his own. In my speculation, are factors that led into why Sangin still had Marine advisors.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the population is over, supportive now of ANSF and so forth. Are you at all concerned that with your removal, either the population may be worried and or the Taliban may be emboldened?
You know, that's a good question, but when you went to the basic school, did they have all the signs, the different quotes from leaders throughout history hanging up around Haywood Hall? Do you recall?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right. Do you recall a quote by Napoleon of the morale to the physical being as 3:1?
I don't remember that one, no. No.
Yeah, Now, I know you were there significantly ahead of me. I shouldn't say significantly, but I know you were ahead of me. And it was one of the ones that was hanging up as I was there. And the reality of it is, Major Combat Forces, the area had decreased U.S. troops, and the Afghans had taken the area over in June. And so with the decreased footprint, it's not like there was a large number of combat troops there. Oh, by the way, if you look at Nowzad, Musakala, and Kajaki, they had experienced liftoffs in all those areas, and and those areas remained stable. So, you know, things that contributed to that, to stability, you know, you had the return of the 6th Kandak. The brigade was a Kandak short. Mm-hmm. They had a surge of young officers, and in a centralized structure, those young leaders who came in energetic and motivated to do their job were good for the brigade. And then, as well, the Corps pushed out the Mobile Strike Force in direct support, and the Special Ops Kandaks to execute operations throughout. And then the final thing is they did a maintenance surge, and we saw progress made in their maintenance. So I think I strayed a little bit. Mm-hmm. But if you can go back to the question a bit again, so I can make sure that I didn't miss something, I got excited about it.
I think you hit on it. I'm just asking if the confidence level among both the civilian population and the emboldenment of the Taliban, as a result of the withdrawal.
And that actually fits well into the return of the Kandak, the officers, and seeing these big vehicles, these Afghan, it's kind of like, you've seen the Mobile Strike Force vehicles, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Or at least a picture of them. They're ominous. And oh, by the way, they have an Afghan flag and an Afghan in them. So that, it's like, woof, look at those things. Oh, my goodness, they're owned by the Afghan National Army. And they work well with the brigade. And so seeing these things work together and the police work together, and having this level of confidence, as I mentioned, with Napoleon, I mean, all these things go into the morale of the 2nd Brigade. And so, as the morale of the 2nd Brigade is high, really they're like this, this swift moving water that is just unstoppable. And their positive energy throughout the brigade, is infectious to the local populace from what we can see. Now, none of us can read a crystal ball. Maybe you can. I know I can't. I can't predict the future. But looking at them right now and seeing, and hearing the brigade commander and hearing members of his staff talk about winning and talk about, we're going to win, we're going to succeed in Sangin and the surrounding area. I'm optimistic. I really am. I'm honored to have been part of it because, I put it bluntly, I'm a winner. I didn't come here to lose. I sure didn't come here to play for a tie. And so when I've got a brigade commander that, wasn't talking about winning when I got here, but sure was when I left, and seeing that and, inspire his soldiers and see that, inspire the people of the Sangin area, all while he was maintaining stability in three other districts, I think the future is bright.
And that's that intangible there, then, this notion that they're going to win, they have confidence, it's sort of unstoppable. Is that sort of, did you feel them at some point sort of turn a corner and kind of, again, the momentum shifted from one of maybe we're not prevailing to one of maybe it's a draw to one of unstoppable?
I do. I felt there was a definite shift. And, I mean, when we got there, and you know, it was, you know, an internal focus, and you know, they were taking a high number of casualties, and the and you know, it's been significant contact over time. They were in the process of ripping out of a number of areas, kind of what, you know, over time. So you know, you have to think, you know, to them what that looked like for guys that have been serving with Marines and you know, coalition forces for years. Now, you know, make no mistake, they love their, they, you know, they love the coalition. You know, they love Marines. You know, frankly, they, the men of the 2nd Brigade still talk of their, you know, their friends, you know, having come from 5th Marines and 7th Marines, and in some, you know, some cases where others had served with, you know, others in, say, 6th Marines in other areas prior to coming to Sangin. And so it's been for them a, you know, a friendship, and, you know, that, you know, that, you know, it's like, you know, now, hey, you know, you guys are close to being in the lead. Now you're in the lead. And, oh, by the way, now you're the one taking casualties. And I think there was probably a little bit of an internal focus, but they really began to generate tempo and momentum as time went on. And you know, as the elections began to approach, they picked it up with a level of intensity that really was inspiring. I mean, I can't, like I said, I can't tell you how honored I am to have been a part of it. I mean, it was really a fulfilling experience in, you know, in my humble career.
Yeah. No, I can see how that would be. And is there also a concern on their part about enablers and support, be it air or fire support or medevac?
Well, the you know, one of the things, you know, and that's a good question, because, you know, as you know, yeah, we were doing many of the air medevacs for them. Now, one of the things to think about is, you know, they've been doing successfully executing casualty care from point of injury to the CANDAC and brigade headquarters. And while we've been doing some air medevacs, as we, you know, there have been cases where they have executed ground medevacs for people that, frankly, we would have executed an air medevac for. And so, you know, one of the things to think about as well is, you know, they utilized the MI-17s multiple times in support of the elections. And so, you know, yeah, they've got challenges ahead, but they've made progress in their own solutions to medical evacuations. So, I mean, yeah, there's challenges ahead, but I really believe that they're up to the task and that they're, you know, they're going to find a solution. And you know, as they've shown that they will.
And when you say medevacs, had we up until you guys left been providing that brigade with medevacs when the situation were particularly dire? And will that cease now, or how will that work?
In some cases, we were providing medevacs. You know, as far now, when we say medevacs, you know, there's the different categories. If it was, you know, if there was no threat to life, loss of a limb or eyesight, you know, they had it. And, you know, we saw an enhanced capability at the brigade level for them to treat their own casualties. So in some cases where I think probably, you know, when we first got here, where it would have been a threat to, you know, loss of one of those criteria, they were in fact treating somebody to an acceptable level for, you know, for their medical system. Now, that said, as well, in some cases where we would have executed a medical evacuation, they were executing a ground medevac. And so, you know, over time, it wasn't, you know, that it was a complete reliance. they were executing their own brigade solution, you know, in preparation to for our eventual departure. And so, you know, they're going to continue to execute that as they, you know, as they had been in cases, and they're going to continue to work towards the utilization of the MI-17s in some cases as necessary. But they've got a number of different options that they had begun to exercise towards the end of our tenure there.
Yeah, would they be able to get a medevac from Corps level now with advisors there, or are they pretty much on their own at this point forward?
They're on their own, but they're ready to be on their own. I mean, because as they've demonstrated that they have the capacity to do it. It's not, you know, this isn't one of those like, yeah, hey, good luck, fellas. No, I mean, it's like they've, you know, if we were to, you know, if we were to do it like a TAC eval from TBS, I mean, they have exercised the capability to do it. So they, you know, they literally they don't need us in that capacity.
And I mean, could you're talking about medevacs now? Could the same be said for across the board? In other words, they have the capacity to do it. They don't need us.
Yeah, they. I mean, like I said, they have. You know, they're completely on their own because they've demonstrated the capability to be on their own. You know, it's not going to be without challenge ahead, but I believe that they're up to the task.
Yeah. And just finally, I'll ask you to sort of take a 30,000-foot view. I don't think you were there in 2009 or anything like that, but, you know, the surge of forces kind of went into Helmand, a pretty bad place. Now you're the last, you know, Marine advisory team to lift off. That's like, whoops, gosh, 5 years. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll tell you what my thoughts are is that, you know, if you look at the, you know, the amount, the level of involvement that coalition forces have had in the Sangin, and, you know, and I'll speak to the 2nd Brigade in their area, and, you know, having looked at, you know, we went from a significant number of coalition force troops, a significant number of Marines that executed operations, and we're moving towards establishing a level of security that ultimately facilitated the introduction of Afghan forces. Facilitated the introduction of a system of governance, right? And then, you know, that set the foundation. Then, over time, they began to develop their capability. And so, you know, so from, you know, the 30,000-foot view, we really were the recipients of just a tremendous amount of hard work by previous Marine units that set the foundations for stability and security, to introduce governance and Afghan security forces that then trained these, you know, partnered with these elements that then developed the capacity that ultimately, you know, led to where we were with, you know, small refinements in the ability to plan, coordinate, and execute operations. So it's been, seeing where they are now and, you know, not having been here for what they were before, but, you know, and knowing how much Marines have invested in the area, you know, it's humbling to be the last guys out to see what Marines have contributed to for the last few years. And that is a successful 2nd Brigade in what was probably the most kinetic area in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Sangin, when was the sort of peak of the kinetics, do you think, in Sangin?
The peak of the kinetics in Sangin would have been 2011. Yeah, I would say 2011, based off of kind of the research coming here.
Yeah, yeah. And it was really one of the most kinetic areas in all of Afghanistan.
And probably depending upon who you talk to, so probably safer to say in a very highly kinetic area of all of Afghanistan. I'm sure it probably depends on what whose perspective you ask.
Yeah.
But by all accounts, even the Afghans will say that it's been a very kinetic area.
And did the brigade, when you were leaving, was there a bit of don't go, or and you had to convince them, hey, you guys are ready? Or was it more like, we'll see you later, thanks? Were they sorry to see you go, and was there a little bit of, hey, can you stay a little longer?
Yeah, but it wasn't from what you would think it was. It wasn't like, oh, go, don't go, we're not ready. It was like, having worked with them each and every day, it was a level of friendship and partnership that had developed. And so, as our preparations to depart came, frankly, daily they talked about, hey, we know we're ready, but we like working with you. We see it as a partnership. And so more of the assets began to flow out, again, they, as we got here, there was, if you think about it like this, one of my officers said it best when he said, when we got here, he's like, sir, there's gonna come a point. He's like, they need us now, and he had served here previously. He had said, they need us now, but there's gonna come a point that they don't need us anymore. They just want us. And that's frankly, they got to a point as we departed that, they wanted us there, but they really don't need us. And that desire for us to be there was really based upon the fact of friendship, as they said, as they came out and saw us off. And, it was an emotional time for some because, they had developed this level of friendship with, their counterparts and, and from all levels of the brigade side and of the SFAT side. And there, it's that warrior culture that develops, as we're brothers in arms, serving together, regardless of uniform, regardless of nationality, they saw us as their warrior brothers. And, it was an emotional time for them, to see us go but that was one thing that they had said was, we are excited for you to go home so that you can go home and see your families, because Marines have done, and the United States has done so much for us over time. We're excited for you. We're sad to see you go because, together, we enjoy, we like working with you. We love you as brothers, as warriors.
Yeah. Well, sir, this is great. Is there anything I neglected to ask that you'd like to add, or did we cover everything?
Well, if I can add anything, it's, one of the things that we saw as I mentioned, we saw this enhanced, actually I didn't mention it, but I alluded to it. We saw this enhanced effectiveness and efficiency throughout the course of our time there. And, across all the, sections within the brigade. But what we also saw was, an enhanced effectiveness and efficiency of training. And so, while they were, they have members of the brigade that are, receiving training in other countries, some in the United States and France and others, the most significant thing is that they, as the as our time wound down, they had a mobile training team from the Regional Corps Battle School, which is located here in Schorbach or in Leatherneck, come up to Sangin. And so we had these, and we had Afghan-led classes by Afghan instructors. So it was solely an Afghan-led event. And so this, they conducted a training package without coalition support, you know, that covered offensive and defensive operations. Now, why that's significant is because, you know, as we mentioned, the zone the brigade is in, many of these soldiers would go to these courses and then would, you know, practical application be on, in some sort of security at night and be able to, you know, utilize these enhanced marksmanship skills, you know, with all the different weapons systems, et cetera. But, you know, like I said, you know, the most important thing is that it was Afghan planned, coordinated, led, and executed. And so really, you know, as I mentioned, that goes into the, you know, they want us but no longer need us category, because, you know, across the board, offensive and defensive operations, and, oh, by the way, their own training. I mean, you know, that's winning. That's exciting.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. And so when are you coming back to the States?
We're waiting to see what our flight window is.
Okay. Great. And then you've been there
sometime in the next week or so.
And it's been a 7-month deployment for you, or?
Right. We got here in October, and so 7 months. Okay. It's gone quickly. It's been, like I said, it's been a rewarding experience.
Yeah.
They truly are a remarkable group of warriors, and it's an honor to have been part of this, just to see what, you know, what Marines have accomplished, you know, prior to us getting here. And it's, you know, it's an honor to have been, you know, here at the end for it, because really, you know, the success that we enjoyed was really due in large part to the years of hard work, hard work and loss and over the past few years. I mean, it's really about that. It's about, you know, the brigade and their desire to succeed, more than anything that we've done. Really, it's humbling.
Yeah. Well, sir, again, safe travels on the way back, and congratulations for wrapping up a successful tour, and hope we can stay in touch.
Awesome. Yeah, if there's anything that you want to follow up on or have clarified, whoever your point of contact is here can grab me, and I'll be more than happy to, you know, even if it's a, hey, I just got a question. Got it. I'm here for you. It's the warrior servant in all of us. So
great. Well, thanks again, and safe travels back.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.